I remember being back in primary school with my primary teacher, Mrs. McCormick, who probably had more influence on me than I've realised myself until maybe quite recently, and it's probably more than she ever realised. And she was talking about the idea of sharing. And she said, if you got a box of chocolates, would you go away in a corner and eat them by yourself, or would you share them around with other people? And she said, you might get all the chocolates yourself, and it might feel good eating the chocolates, but would you be happy? And would you be happy to see all the other faces of the other children not having anything?
You're listening to Humans of Politics, a podcast about how it feels to be a politician. My name is A.B. Philbin Bowman, and my guest today is the Scottish National Party MP, Angus Brendan McNeill.
And I suppose you can extend that small lesson from primary school into the larger world and of inequality at the moment. And that's something that does bother me. It bothers me the intergenerational. It bothers me that young people haven't got the same chances that we have. And I'm only 49 now. Probably some people think that's quite old now. But there's an inequality amongst people at the moment, and I never think it's healthy. And I come from a small island of about 1,200 people, the island of Barra on the south end of the Hebrides, reputedly to be named after a former Bishop of Cork, St. Barr, and I think Guggen Barra in Cork's also named after him. But anyway, that idea of inequality, you know, a small island, that is worse as well. You know, if you see people doing quite badly or being held back, or if benefits are going, or if there's not the social safety nets there, it is something that I find bothersome, and I do like and admire societies that iron that out better and more effectively than other places, and I think particularly of the Nordic societies, and that's probably one of the reasons I'm pushing for Scottish independence, and that I see that possibility more easier to manage and to establish in the 4 to 5 million people of Scotland than in the 60 plus million that tend to vote Tory in dangerous numbers in too far too frequently general elections.
And just in terms of coming from that island background, it's one of the most remote parts of the UK in terms of, if this is considered the capital, it's one of the furthest from the capital. How did it feel growing up in that culture, and how remote and relevant did this place where you now work seem?
You're right, London is very remote from the Outer Hebrides, and this place is largely pretty irrelevant, to be honest. I mean, other than the broadcast media throwing it in your direction. Unfortunately, probably too many of its policies would be reaching us for my comfort. When you're back at home in the islands, incidentally, Gaelic-speaking, bilingual, this place can seem, indeed, quite far away. And I'm glad sometimes it seems quite far away until we're told that there's a hurried vote and we better get ourselves down as fast as we can, which has been happening a bit too often with Brexit recently.
And in terms of that remoteness and that distance, what strain does that put on your life trying to be in your constituency and at the same time, this is part of what, you know, you work here. I'm just wondering about the strain that puts on you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the definite strain of geography there and the demand and the expectation of trying to be in several places, probably about three places at once. So I stay in the south end of the Hebrides, and about the same distance, Malin Head is probably as far away from me as Stornoway is in the north. Not quite as far, but I mean, it's almost an equidistant kind of thing. So between getting around the constituency, it's the longest constituency in the UK Parliament, and then getting from there to London. And when you are in the islands, you've got to fly firstly to Glasgow, hope weather doesn't interfere, I hope your interfaces go. Some days you can get down in 4 hours. I mean, you're probably better coming in than guys in Yorkshire or Cornwall or whatever in Wales. But other days things can go wrong and you find yourself 7-8 hours, like indeed I was on Monday coming down. Other times you might be heading back north, plane might not go, you don't get to Glasgow early enough, you have to spend an overnight in Glasgow. So you do have quite a lot of time wasted in airports, and I'm very familiar with the inside of Glasgow Airport. I should have a timeshare inside Glasgow Airport.
And what about the impact on your personal life? Because, and I know it's in the public domain that, you know, you're separated from your wife, and I don't in any way want to get into the personal details of that because it's private. But we are here to talk about the personal impact of a career in politics and the impact on you as a human and the hours that you work and, in your case, the hours you have to travel. I am curious about your perspective on what kind of a toll that takes on a relationship.
On a personal way, for your marriage and that sort of, I mean, it's a disproportionate amount of MPs when you're out of contact with a spouse have problems like that. That seems to be, you're exposing yourself to higher risk. It's probably like smoking. You know, it's something like you are exposing yourself to higher risk. And, you know, it's very hard also to to make commitments just to general friends, to say, I'll be in such and such, or I'll meet you in Glasgow for a meal or something, or I'll see you in London, because you're just moving so much. And the other thing about politics is, when I remember this feeling in 2005 when I was first elected, there's enough activity in a week of politics that would fit your social professional life in about a month. So you are running, there's a high, sort of high octane stuff of politics, and you do see politicians around who are just addicted to being active and busy. They're just needing to be doing things. Whether it's fertile or futile, they just do enjoy, they get on the treadmill or the hamster wheel of being busy, and that happens and that can take over, and probably has and does take over for me as well.
Is there a sense in which you're not allowed to switch off, or you're not allowed to have a private life? As somebody who's had your privacy intruded on and your private life kind of occasionally splashed all over tabloids, do you feel like you're constantly under scrutiny or constantly being watched?
I mean, I think, firstly, I mean, opinions of newspapers never, still don't bother me. And folk can say and do what they kind of like. I mean, for myself, when I'm home in the island, it's fine. I mean, I'm with probably a bunch of 1,000 people, the best part of them I've known for the last 40, 50 years. And that's basically my life, mostly. And yet, politics is always going to be subject to all sorts of things that have nothing to do with politics. That's just, you've got to shrug your shoulder and just carry on. Most of those things, you forget. And actually, when I see other MPs getting some, what they feel are stress from media, that really is tomorrow's fish and chip paper.
And in terms of your entry into politics, you sort of came in making quite a bit of noise, exposing some of the corruption in the Labour Party. What was it like doing that?
Yeah, that was the famous cash for honours, when you mysteriously gave £1 million to Tony Blair's Labour Party. You shockingly found yourself wandering into the House of Lords, or into a knighthood, mostly the House of Lords. It was all completely coincidental, of course, the relationship of giving £1 million and the relationship of finding yourself in the House of Lords. But, you know, we'd gathered enough information and compiled enough that we got the police to start to investigate. Labour themselves at the time, and Tony Blair's government, were getting a bit reckless about it. Even there were voices within the Labour movement, such as Jack Dromey, who's now an MP, and Jack Dromey had said that he had been uncomfortable. I think he was National Treasurer. So we sort of got this together, put some stoppers on it, reported to the police, and we looked up that this wasn't just a political discussion, but there was actually an Act of Parliament in 1923, which had the Honours Prevention of Abuses Act. Three simple paragraphs: don't buy honours, don't sell honours, and if you do, you could get 2 years in prison. So on the basis of that, Tony Blair was interviewed under caution by the Metropolitan Police. It went nowhere in the end, but it's an area that none of them want to talk about now at all, on the record.
And was that exhilarating? Was that, I mean, did you feel like a detective sort of finding all this, putting together? I mean, or was it daunting? What was the backlash? I'm just wondering, just at a personal level, what it was like.
Yeah,
you.
I think the feeling was, you're in politics, I have a feeling that life is short. I have a feeling that time in politics is shorter. If you ever get into government, it's shorter still. And you should maybe take opportunities when they present themselves. So when I got into politics, and before that, I was aware of this carry-on kind of in my teenage years, early 20s, when the Tories were in power. And I thought, well, you've got the opportunity now, you're going to try and do something about it. I mean, it might go nowhere. So it was a mildly detective, exhilarating. It was a bit scary at the time to find yourself in the centre of something quite that big. But you just sort of jumped on it and followed it wherever it went. And I wasn't really involved too much. And once the police got going with it, that was it. And I just kicked it off, and the police carried it on and interviewed certain people. I do remember a Labour MP telling me at the time, or asking me at the time, the SNP don't send people to the House of Lords, so how do you raise money? So I mean, it was that open secret around the House of Commons and the House of Lords that, you know, you got to take a step back. You know, we're talking a democracy here, and firstly, we've got a House of Lords that's appointed. That in itself is an aberration. And in the democracy that is the UK, in the legislature, there's two houses. There are more people in the House of Lords. We have more politicians appointed and hereditary than we do elected. And then it gets worse in that some people can give money and find themselves in the legislature. That's a corruption of banana republic. I don't think actually banana republics do that sort of thing. It's that bad. And so when we really take a step back, and rather than just say, oh, well, this is how we raise money, we'll stick such and such a rich idiot into the House of Lords who's quite willing to throw away £1 million for a title he can wear down the tennis club, when we take democracy seriously, we can't be doing that sort of thing.
Moving on, you've mentioned both Scottish independence and Brexit, and I'm just struck that you've been through those two campaigns now, both of which excite very strong sense passions around people's sense of identity, where they feel they belong to, the kind of country they want to live in. What are your reflections personally on seeing those two votes, and in your case, votes that in, I think both cases didn't go the way you wanted them to?
Absolutely, I'm a serial loser when it comes to the Americans' favourite word, a loser. Firstly, the Scottish independence referendum was very disappointing. I mean, 45% voted for independence. We were told at that stage, Scotland, vote to stay in the United Kingdom, don't just be part of it, lead it. Scotland, guarantee your place in the European Union by staying in the United Kingdom. Within 21 months, of course, we were being taken out against our will. 62% of Scots then voted to stay in the European Union, versus 55% voting to stay in a United Kingdom in the European Union.
And I know the numbers and I know the arguments, yeah. But I'm interested in what impact you've seen it have on people and on just at a personal level in terms of the kinds of passions that have been aroused, the kind of anger that's come into politics, just how that's changed, how you represent the people that you do represent.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was two different reactions. I think the biggest reaction, the most interesting reaction, was the reaction of the 2014 referendum. There was a feeling that people were sort of lied to, and that came quite quickly with David Cameron, his stance the following morning about English laws, English votes for English laws. And then there was a big surge in growth from the SNP. I mean, the SNP went from a membership of about 25,000-28,000 to a membership of 125,000-128,000. It was absolutely staggering growth altogether. I think we doubled our membership. And you could almost say that the referendum was probably the best thing that could have... It was the second best result that we had. We wanted to complete devolution, take the powers by Scotland, make Scotland independent, make Scotland like Ireland, Norway, whatever. The Euro referendum was quite different. It was a far lower key affair. I mean, I just didn't think until, I think I ventured it once at an energy breakfast in the Mayfair Hotel in London to a packed hall that, you know, this Brexit, despite some voices saying this wouldn't go through. I remember telling this packed room that it's a possibility it could go through, given I'd spoken to STV's news editor on an ITV regional news editor as they look at it, Bernard Ponsonby, and he said, well, all the other regionals in England are saying they're all going to vote for Brexit. It's only me in London that are saying we won't be voting for Brexit. On that basis, it would go through. And, you know, there's a sort of disbelief. Only one man took me seriously in the audience, who was an Irishman, who basically thought, what will this mean for Ireland? I said, well, you can scavenge on the bones of what's left of the UK pretty well. There'll be good pickings for 4 or 5 million of the bones of 60 million. So Brexit went through, state of disbelief, exasperation. Can this stupid idea really go forward? When's it going to go off the rails? It's still going on. They still believe the nonsense about it. But we do know that it's going to damage GDP and all these things they talk about, trade agreements. They're mad for trade agreements, not so much trade, but they're mad for trade agreements. And there's no amount of trade agreements that they can get that will make up any more than about 1.4, 1.5% of GDP if they get trade agreements with every country in the world. That will make up for the 6 to 8% they're going to lose through not being members of the European Union. But if you believe in Victorianism and the ideals of the sort of opium wars, and if that forms your outlook in the world, don't be surprised if you do some economic damage to yourself and to your children when you start believing fantasies like that.
Is there a politician who you disagree with on Brexit completely, but who you like or admire at a personal level?
Yeah, quite a number, actually. I mean, I'm not the sort of person who ever falls out with somebody because I don't like their ideas. And if I think somebody's ideas are daft or stupid or ill thought out or maybe misguided, you know, I'll argue the point. So, you know, there's Nigel Evans, one of the first guys that maybe springs to mind, a Conservative. I'm chair of the International Trade Committee, and he's the sort of vice chair of the committee. Now, he's a mad Brexiteer, almost a rabid Brexiteer, I'd call him. And we can fight like cat and dog in front of any audience that comes the way and really mean it, you know. But there's no personal animosity whatsoever there. I mean, once our argument is done, there's no point falling out with the guy. And he feels the same way in response. There's no point falling out with somebody because he doesn't agree with your views. And I think, you know, you've got to maintain a civilised way and a democratic way. And that means listening. It means learning. It means arguing. It means changing your mind or changing his mind. And trying to avert damage.
How does being an MP and having the commute and the workload, how does it impact the kind of father that you try to be?
I think you've got to just got to be as relaxed as you can. That's a difficult one. I'm sure I'll get a debrief on that in years to come. I mean, my youngest daughter is down with me just now. She's in the October holidays from school in Scotland, and she's here this week and next week. She quite enjoys being in London, and you know, we'll can make time in these 2 weeks to go and see. So we'll see bits of London that I wouldn't normally see because she came down. So actually, maybe she's giving me the holiday by coming down rather than her being on holiday, because you do have to make sure that you're doing things that are for her as opposed to just following the treadmill and the hamster wheel that is Westminster.
Fair enough. And how do you unwind?
Well, at the moment, I've been repairing a quad bike at home. So now I keep sheep, and that is quite in between agriculture, swimming. I do quite a bit of swimming, watch maybe a disproportionate amount of football. Then you turn the channel, you're back on to watching news, so you're back on to work. You're thinking about things like that. And yeah, I just like being home. I mean, I'm quite fortunate where I live. I mean, there's a beach in front of Barasgar. I don't know, it's an island of about 10 by 6, and we must have a best part of about 15, 20 beaches. So, and we've got hills and lochs. So I'm extremely lucky in where I live, and I just like being there.
Angus, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to Humans of Politics Season 2. There'll be more from Westminster next week. If anything got you angry or got you thinking, all feedback is welcome. I am on Twitter as AB Philbin Bowman, at ABIEPB. Finally, you've probably noticed that we are living through a time when democracy itself is under attack and where political debate has become angry, distrustful and hyper-partisan. And I'm not suggesting that we can single-handedly reverse that with podcasts, but if you think that conversations like this are a step in the right direction and you'd like more people to discover it, the easiest and cheapest thing you could do would be to leave us a nice review wherever you listen. Thanks again.